Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Joseph.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 99th anniversary of the murder of the royal family, the torture, murder, and then sexual assault of the royal family and their dog. And so as a result of that, we're going to dedicate the program to them. Really, this entire broadcast, this entire podcast, lecture project is dedicated to them. They're the foundation. Tsar Nicholas was the last Roman ruler after Sophie Palaiologos had married Ivan III. The Byzantine Roman Empire then became married into the Empire of Moscow. And then only after that, they had the right to use the double-headed eagle. Now, there's been a lot of people writing about Tsar Nicholas, about his policies, and I've done that on this program more than once. His record is there for all to see. It would be economics or taxes or everything else. He is one of the most successful rulers of the era. But that role, the last Roman Empire, the restrainer, is what brought down the ire of the Jews and Antichrist. Remember that Great Britain and France had denied Nicholas entry. The only person, and this isn't talked about enough, the only person who sought for the freedom of the royal family was Germany. They were cousins and should never have been fighting in the first place. Now this, you know, this proves without doubt that, you know, the British used Austria and Serbia to create a situation where their two big rivals, Moscow or St. Petersburg and Berlin, would go and fight each other. Two big threats to the British Empire. World War I is a British creation, but the proximate blame goes to Austria. Britain would do anything, become anything, finance anyone to keep the Russian Empire from expanding. Under Tsar Nicholas, the population was exploding. The diet was the best in Europe. They were pumping oil, the Caucasus Mountains. They were self-sufficient in everything. Imperial Russia was, at that time, the only state in the world that could be completely cut off from the world and have nothing change. They had everything they needed. The economy was exploding, both in terms of industry and in terms of monetization. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that these are all, you know, good things. Working in a factory was miserable. It was penal servitude. And the mines that fed the factory the same way. But in a secular way that these things are measured. The Russian Empire had to have some industry in order to keep up. And it's often understated, the explosion of industry in the Russian Empire, which was equal to that of Prussia. Because Russia is so large, and reputation being what it is, it never gets this kind of credit. American academia, as you know, is a frequent target of my contempt. I know these people personally. I know them by their work. And they've been telling students stories and myths about Russia in their various classes and seminars. And I was removed from Mount St. Mary's University. That was one of the reasons. There was a summer enrichment program for the faculty. I believe it was summer of 08. And I was on Russia. So I was asked to give the main address. A big mistake on their part. I went in there and very calmly told the truth. and only the Jewish music professor was my friend and supported me and defended me this whole time. Agreed with me. The only one who was willing to stand up for me. And that was the beginning of the end for me there. Jews as Antichrist have a special hatred for Rome. Rome is the antitype to the perversion of Jerusalem, or a Kabbalah version of Jerusalem. Two Jews who control the process, the massacre of the royal family, Dzerzhinsky and Sverdlov, were the two main figures. Of course, Lenin had wanted them dead for a long time. But how this was to be done and by whom was an issue. Well, what they did to the bodies after they killed them. Pavel Medvedev couldn't stop vomiting. He was someone he refused to take part. He was there. He didn't really take part in it, and he saw what they did. Sex with corpses. They were tearing into the flesh of the family. Anastasia was the last to die, and they made sure it was slow. But long after they were dead, they would tear and tear and tear. So this wasn't an assassination. What they were doing, attempting to destroy the concept of Rome, the Third Rome, the Russian Orthodoxy. Pontiff House has been the subject of great speculation. The real name was Geltzer, a Jewish name, and it was initially built by a gold merchant of ill repute. It already had a symbolic significance, both as a Jewish center and as a gold trading center. I actually read, and I kid you not, and this is, you know, university professor is saying that the marks on the wall, symbols on the wall, were just Yurovsky making sure that his pen was working. So he tried it out on the wall before he wrote. This is a university professor. Now, of course, he knows he's not telling the truth. But the murder of Tsar Nicholas and the family was a purely Jewish affair. And if it's a Jewish affair, it's going to be a sexual affair. The reason why Medvedev, there were two Medvedevs there, but one Pavel testified later that he simply couldn't stomach what they were doing to the bodies as they lay dead or very close to, you know, moribund. Belshazzar, comment from Daniel 5. The symbols on the wall are you know, manifest. This Hebrew tradition, in fact, in 1942, was used again in an assassination in Palestine. The exact same symbolism, the same interpretation. Except, you know, they didn't put the czar in there, but so this was clearly a Jewish ritual killing. There's simply no getting out of it. So it's stated that here on orders of secret forces or secret elements, the king is sacrificed to destroy the state. All nations are now put on notice. There were also drawings of Rasputin and the Empress having sex on the wall. The Jews in the press had an obsession with that. As I've said many times before, the press was almost exclusively Jewish owned. And the major, you know, your major dailies in the big cities. And they weren't newspapers, not by any stretch of the imagination. They were ethnic advocates. They didn't report on things. The two things of interest to us that they lied about was candidates, you know, running for office for the Duma, for example, a Bolshevik or a Social Democrat, the press would never say what they really believed. They would never say what they really were calling for. They'd speak to different groups of constituents differently. There were no, you know, parties in the modern sense there. You know, we use some abbreviations like Octoberists and nonsense like that. These weren't parties in the American sense. So they would deliberately distort these candidates. The election results, the four Dumas, are nonsense. But the big thing that they lied about was trying to get at Tsar Nicholas. Now, we talked about this with Rasputin and the Empress. They had this fixation that Rasputin and the Empress were sexually involved. And you see that pornography at the Ipatiev House, and you see it in Jewish history in Russia since Nicholas was made Tsar. The murders were done on orders, at least locally. The head of the Ural Soviet, Loshikin, an extremely Jewish name. And so the chain of command, so to speak, you know, Lenin was a passive recipient of this. But, you know, Dzerzhinsky in Petersburg and Sverdlov, both Jewish. And then that command went to two other Jews, Loshikin and the main one, Jacob Yurovsky. So this was a purely Jewish affair. Now, there were a few thugs of non-Jewish background. Medvedev was one of them. They were kind of there to, you know, to get rid of the bodies and to get rid of, you know, the acid and stuff like that they needed to do. But they weren't part of this. This was a ritual slaying and a ritual killing. They wake up the royal family very early in the morning and said that they're going to be moved and go to a new place, getting out of here. Rather, they're taken down to the basement. I think Tsar Nicholas always had a sense that this was, you know, that this was going to be the end. And they finally get in position. A few of them are in chairs. Of course, the Tsarevich could not stand, and the Empress was ill. Tsar Nicholas says to Yurovsky, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Here's what I'm doing. Here's what." And he holds the gun and began shooting. It's a Mauser and several pistols. This didn't kill them. They shot a few shots, but the actual killing was done with bayonets, fists, and raping. We should note, and this is something that I've only learned recently, that the New Mortar priest, Stepan Bogodov, wrote that Yurovsky was beaten to death by peasants in a riot later in 1918 for that very crime. The very fact that the Reds were so concerned that the monarchy could be a rallying point shows you how popular it was. Now, the white armies were not royalist. In fact, Denikin, less so Wrangel, but they all ultimately distanced themselves from the monarchy. Not because it was unpopular, but because it was they were in service of the provisional government. Royalist forces fought within the white army. The white armies were not themselves royalists at all. In fact, they had no ideology that anyone could figure out. Then a few days, the Bolsheviks tried to figure out how much money they had. All the jewels, they mean their personal property, not the state property. And it came down to 14 million rubles. Now, this would include the land, the money, actual cash and jewels, which is at the time roughly, let's say 1917, 1916, A ruble was twice as valuable as a dollar. So we're talking about a few million dollars. And this, you know, allegedly, this was the so-called fortune of the royal family. Now, keep something in mind, and this is something that's come up often and irritates me. The President of the United States doesn't own the White House. The Pope of Rome doesn't own the Vatican. I saw a meme the other day, and it said the Roman Catholic Church is sitting on trillions of dollars in real estate and refused to do anything about the poor. And I laughed. And I said, as if they could simply liquidate whatever parish they want and take that money. These are parishes. These are monasteries. It's going into the value. Of course, you know, they have thousands of parishes. Take all those real estate, everything else. It's a huge amount. That doesn't mean they actually have that liquid. But it shows you how simple-minded people are. So we have to separate the state property that the Romanov family was allowed to use versus their personal property. And with everything, including, you know, jewels that they've inherited and everything else, it comes down to $7 million. I also want to note that when the Moscow Patriarchate canonized Tsar Nicholas and the royal family, the Jewish newspaper, the Jewish International Press, said that they hoped that this canonization, you know, there was no stress, the ritual side of things was not mentioned at all. And the Jewish press stated that this will put to rest this idea that this was a Jewish cabal. You know, they were very, very concerned that it be associated with that. In Russia, of course, it's a day-to-day thing. I was asked the other day about the so-called Holocaust denial law in Russia. Well, I read it in the original. It has nothing to do with the Holocaust. It has to do primarily with attacking the honor of the state in defeating the invader. It wasn't really ideological. It had nothing to do with glorifying Stalin. But regardless, Germans did invade Russia. And in defeating that invader, and I should note that, of course, not a single person has been prosecuted. So why this occurred, and this was done in the Duma, Putin signed it, it seemed to be purely symbolic. And I say this because saying that Tsar Martyr was murdered by a Jewish cabal is day-to-day there. Shopkeepers talk about it. Duma members talk about it. Judges talk about it. It's mentioned in school. It's an ordinary thing. Here, you can lose your job and even your life. But there, it's a day-to-day thing. Remember, Solzhenitsyn's 200 years together was published on a major press. So this is not something that you have to be frightened about there. The time of the royal family in captivity was pretty miserable. They were closely watched. The beautiful daughters, I hate to think, you know, with that kind of temptation, these disgusting creatures, you know, away from any family that they may have had, I it's almost impossible to think that they weren't violated in some way. They certainly were in the basement of the house, but having them there, and, you know, no one's going to discipline them for that, you know. It was just boring. They were given prison rations, you know, played cards and everything else. The language of the family was English, which some people forget. And about 4 or 5 hours out of the day, the children were instructed in history. This was the big discipline for Tsar Nicholas and Alexandra and the family. And it was done in English and focused on Russian history, especially from 1613 onward. I want to stress one more time, you know, Count Mirbach, Kaiser Wilhelm, made it very clear that he wanted to rescue the Tsar, but he didn't, you know, he would pretty much do whatever the Reds wanted after Britain and France had closed their doors to him. It's very important, and I mention that because Russia and Germany are natural allies. I said that in the beginning, and I wanted to stress that one more time. There had to have been some sense in Russia that the monarchs were going to be killed, because royalists, parishes, had taken up a collection. They came up with about 250,000 rubles, all told, in ransom. The German government also assisted in that respect. But the fear was that the monarchy was truly a religious institution. Wherever they went, that's where Russia went. So not only were they going to be killed, they were going to be tortured and violated in every way possible. It was a ritual killing. There's absolutely no doubt about it. Tsar Nicholas and his family were sacrificed to demons in exchange for power. Their official press release, the Red said that they tried Tsar Nicholas and executed him. They said nothing about the family. In fact, you read in the Washington Post and numerous American papers. I've reprinted them on my Facebook page. The American press all said that Tsar Nicholas was executed after a trial, and that the family was sent to a place of safety. The Reds did not divulge that they had slaughtered the entire family and the dog. Tsar Nicholas was at one point a very successful ruler of the largest country in the world, the main rival, global power to Great Britain. And now he was forced to live in cramped quarters, eating garbage. God knows what they did to the kids, what they did to the Tsarevich, who was very, very, very ill. And the guards often made fun of them. And said, every once in a while, there'd be a guard that showed him respect. Really depended. But some of the guards would make fun of them and mock them, especially the women and the girls, I should say. Tsar Nicholas really loved physical labor. Now, I mention all of this because, our lives sometimes take this path. Jesus Christ was God. In order to take the punishment that human beings deserved for their sins, he became a human being. He became man. And not only was he not respected as God, but he was mocked and humiliated and executed in the worst conceivable way that the Roman Empire and the Jewish mind could come up with. Not just crucifixion, but crucifixion with nails. His resurrection was believed, really, at the time by the church, which is very small. Pontius Pilate's wife and Pilate eventually converted, and they were convinced of its truth, especially given the size of the stone and the fact that the apostles were in hiding. One way you know that the New Testament is historically accurate is that if it were made up, women would not be the heralds of the resurrection, because at the time Hebrew practice, women were not allowed to testify in court. And yet they're the ones to testify first to the resurrection. They would never say that if this were some made up. In fact, they wouldn't say anything they said about Christ in any of the Gospels if he were made up. If you wanted to make up a religion and get followers, Christ was the absolute last person you would want to. It's almost like it was designed to push people away, as if to say, if I'm successful, it's from God and God only. Regardless of that, the church is small. Tsar Nicholas, the same thing. Often we are misunderstood. We're treated very poorly. People who at one time showed us respect show us contempt. I lost my job, university, and these were major setbacks in my life. Two university jobs I was fired from for these reasons. And the only thing you could think of is that this is what happened to Christ, this is what happened to Nicholas, this is what happened to all the prophets. The farther and farther away from the truth society gets, the more vicious the punishment is going to be. You see the final pictures of Tsar Nicholas. You see the bags under his eyes. You see the guards in the background. Actually, we'll have that. This picture should be the main picture for this broadcast on the website. And you see the misery. And there was no doubt in his mind that he was going to be dead soon. In fact, he was saying this in the late 19th century, that he was going to be the last Tsar. There were too many prophecies saying that this was going to be the case. St. John Maximovich was of the opinion that Alexander III was so successful that it lulled the royalists into a certain complacency, that the problem with the revolution absolutely had nothing to do with the Reds. And this is a small Jewish sect financed from Jewish bankers in New York and Washington. It was because the defenders of the crown were too few and weren't fervent enough. And you could hardly blame them, because all the respectable dailies were saying that the royal family, these are traitors, these are Germans. Rasputin is controlling everything. Rasputin was almost never at the palace. Hinting at an extramarital affair, that they're consulting astrologers and all this other garbage. There was no fact that Rasputin was, as I mentioned in previous broadcasts, was a perfect guy. Going after the royal family directly was dangerous. Using Rasputin was a good foil. You know, everything you know about Rasputin is false. I've had this in a previous broadcast. Rasputin was a very, very good man who had absolutely no power in the palace whatsoever. He was never there. He always wanted to go home. He wanted to leave, but please consult that broadcast if you're concerned. The murder of Rasputin was the first death in the Russian Revolution. Now, this has been an issue since the murder itself. It wasn't reported in the West until the 21st. Who's to blame here? St. John Maximovich, my own Metropolitan Damaskin, I've gotten into some trouble by saying Russia as a whole is to blame. That there was a mass apostasy at all levels. That they believed the lies of the press, whether foreign or domestic, and even, you know, regardless of that, didn't understand what the crown really won. It's not a political institution, it's a religious institution. And if Russia is to blame, this mass apostasy, the church itself certainly bears responsibility. Time of now, the Soborov of 1917-1918 is of highly questionable legitimacy. It was not called by Tsar Nicholas. It was called by the Provisional State, who then put Lvov in charge of the church. In Petrine style, they purged it of royalists, especially Macarius and Petrin, and installed Platon, Agafango, Michael, and Tikhon Bulavin, who was a great saint, of course, but initially was taken in accepted the legitimacy of the council, of course, that elected him patriarch. The election of a patriarch is a very good thing. But one of the first things that council did was to hire Bishop Sergius to rewrite some of the prayers to remove all reference to royalism and the royal family. The official claim was that the provisional government is from God and that all of Russia rejoices in their newfound freedom, which is a direct quote. We know that the Masonic orders were deeply involved in the provisional state. They were a transition point. This weak republic, for lack of Weimar state, though in this case designed to go out of existence. I'm not saying that Tikhon should not be a saint or anything like that, but he did sign his name to some of these documents. Now, there have been other documents. He supported the Soviet state, and those have been proven forgeries. I have a new book coming out on the Barnes Review Press, Confronting Deceit, Revisionist Essays on the True Nature of the Soviet Union. And this is one of the chapters. These are essays, you know, on the nature of the Soviet Union I've done over the years, and have now put them together in a book to be published by the Barnes Review, which should be ready in a few months. But this is one of the concerns. About 10% of the Synod, higher clergy, backed the revolution openly. I'm talking about the whites here, the you know, overthrow of monarchy. But about half blessed the white government, the provisional state. On the anathemas of the Sunday of Orthodoxy, one of the things that Sergius did by the command of that synod was to remove the anathema for those who attack the royal family and monarchs. Now today it's even worse, because it actually has, I've said this before, the present list of anathemas from the Moscow Patriarchate talks about the right believing Peter the First and Catherine the First, Catherine the Second, which is laughable. And then I believe it's just a few items down they condemn Freemasonry. Well, obviously they don't, because no one denies that Peter was a Freemason and surrounded himself with foreign Masons. But at the time, that synod, and this has been kind of a little bit of a black spot for Orthodox historians, I'm not saying good things didn't happen. Those of you who've listened to me in the past know that I am no fan of the Petrine reforms and believe that the synodal system was an utter disaster. It was designed to hurt the church. Peter the Great purged every single major metropolitan see in Russia and installed uncanonically his own friend, Prokopovich. Theophan Prokopovich was an atheist and a materialist. Peter the Great tortured these men who opposed Prokopovich and himself personally. He had bishops broken on the wheel in front of him. But for a man to do that to his own son, doing it to a bishop is, you know, think about what being broken on the wheel is and what that must look like. This is the right believing a monarch, according to the Moscow Patriarchate. At the time, though, any reference to the monarchy was removed. Any reference to the crown was removed. So in the prayer books, references to, you know, the royal family were gone, and in the anathemas, that particular item was gone. Unfortunately, also a part of the 1917 sub-order was Andre of Ufa, actually my favorite new martyr, but he ended up completely rejecting, and going into the old believers, he completely rejected what it did and was aware of what it did. In the defense of those who initially, including St. Tikhon, accepted the white state, the synodal system was an utter disaster. The church could keep, it had no independence, it could not own property, and had no independent source of income, including, you know, the sale of candles, icons, anything. Everything went to the state, and they were put on the salary that got lower and lower and lower. The Oberprocurator of the Synod was often a Mason and an atheist. This happened many times in the 19th century. Now, Pope Donostiev was probably a very good one. But this wasn't always the case. The very fact that Peter the Great put as his chief metropolitan Theophan Prokopovich shows you what the intention was. But to accept this is to violate the oath that they took at the coronation of Tsar Nicholas II. The oath that was stated in 1613. I mention the 1613 oath because all of Russia and all classes were represented, including the peasants, at that synod, that elected a very good man, a boy at the time, Michael. That we swear fealty to the Emperor or Tsar Michael and all of his issue. In other words, members of his family in a hereditary way throughout the age. With the obvious proviso for, you know, rejecting orthodoxy like Peter the Great did. And of course, the oath of allegiance that Russians took at the time of Tsar Nicholas's coronation. And of course, there was the anathema, as I mentioned before, said the Sunday of Orthodoxy, where attacks on the crown, on the Orthodox crown, are anathematized. And that was quickly removed, but that was a political move. So in accepting the white government, you violated at least three or four major oaths that Russia as a nation took and takes very seriously. This is what kept the Romanov line going. And the oath that was taken to end the time of troubles was that Michael and all of his successors are the only legitimate czars of Russia. Now, using the Petrian Synod as an excuse for rejecting the monarchy is unacceptable. We can understand a little bit when certain bishops and monks would rejoice that the synodal system, not rejoice that the czar is gone, but that the Petrian system is gone. Not reforming this, you know, was an error of the 19th century czar. They had far more on their plate. Electing a patriarch was absolutely essential. I only wonder what Tsar Nicholas, now Tsar Nicholas was sympathetic to the idea over time, but of course the war broke out, and then it was simply out of the question. So to some extent, the church was involved in the white movement in the sense that they accepted Kerensky. They saw him not merely as someone we have to passively obey, but someone they actively supported. And Kerensky was up the 33rd degree, and that was well known. And he surrounded himself with members of the Lodge. Remember, I've said this before, Albert Pike and Manly Hall make it clear. Mackey and all these other people, the 19th degree is your consecration to Lucifer. Prometheus. So if you're of the 33rd degree or anything over 19, you're aware of you're a Luciferian. You can't get past the 19th level without it. And that's something that you get another oath that they take, far more important to them than any oath to a monarch. A few days before Tsar Nicholas and the family were butchered, the Ekaterinburg Cathedral saw a slaughter of about 45 people. But the slaughter there was abnormal. They didn't just kill them. They did the same thing to them what they were doing to the royal family. They gouged their eyes out. They violated the corpses. They tortured them and then continued to tear at the corpses after they were dead. And this is odd. And so many people began to realize that this is a manifestation of a demonic movement. The Western press had published rumors some weeks before that the Tsar was already killed. And some of you know what occurred roughly around the time of Tsar Nicholas's abdication. I should say, starting in March of 1917. Summer of 1917, the rejoicing, this was essentially Sergius's declaration, although to the Masonic government. So if you're going to condemn Sergius for this, you need to condemn those who supported the Sobor also of the same thing. 1918, a massive disease, the so-called Spanish flu, the deadliest epidemic in the history of the world. It's only called Spanish flu because the Spanish press was the first to report on it. It wiped out almost 5% of the globe's population. Maybe 75 million people, depending on who you read. In the U.S., life expectancy dropped by 12 years. I'm not sure why this isn't a more common topic, but the world population was put at risk right around the time the Tsar was murdered. Even more, just a few days after he was murdered, the first outbreak was just a couple of months before the execution, but almost to the day of his murder, a new strain was identified that was far more resistant and virulent and fast-moving. The odd thing about the Spanish flu was that it primarily targeted young adults. And the only good thing about that massive epidemic is that Jacob Sverdlov, one of the men who ordered the death of the Tsar, died of it in March of 1918. Now no one's entirely sure where it came from. There's a theory that it came from a military base in Kansas. Some have an Austrian origin for it. Some have an Asian origin for it, depending on who you talk to. And then something also needs to be said here. The flu epidemic, in my opinion, is the release of demons. Once the Tsar was forced to abdicate, remember, the press both in Russia and in the West said that he voluntarily abandoned the throne, that he was so frightened by the people's revolution that he had to leave it. Abdication is kind of an odd term because he really didn't abdicate. That so-called abdication letter was a coded message sent to generals in the front as a telegram demanding greater respect for Tsar Nicholas as commander-in-chief, especially given his victories. It was not meant for public consumption. Furthermore, there was no royal seal to be found anywhere on it. This was not a formal abdication. This was not ever even meant for people to read. This was a message, a coded message, sent to the high command. It had nothing to do with leaving the throne whatsoever. So he did not abdicate. But of course, de facto, there was no other option. No one abdicates by sending a telegram in cryptic language to a few generals at the front, and that's it, with no royal seal and no signature, by the way. It's a very strange way to abdicate. He had no interest in doing that. It didn't matter anyway, because the press was saying that Tsar Nicholas had abandoned the throne, frightened of the people's revolution. And as this is going on, the diphtheria and the Spanish flu pandemic threatens to wipe out the population. So you have an actual physical manifestation of the fall of the Roman Empire. very few states have been legitimate since the fall of the Roman Empire. Those that are, for example, you know, Putin's state today or Lukashenko, are because they imitate some of the virtues of that era and the mentality of that era. It's odd for people to realize, but one of the most nationalist, national socialist parties in the world, the Communist Party of Ukraine and in Russia. These are strict Orthodox Christians, at least at the elite levels. They're pan-Slavs. They're Russian nationalists. They have nothing at all to do with Marx. To be a member of the Communist Party, you can be a full Eurasianist, pan-Slavist, and an Orthodox person. This isn't, you know, Trotsky's Communist Party. In Ukraine, of course, the use of the term is banned. So it's just a socialist party. But these are they're essentially national Bolshevik parties, having no relationship to Sverdlov and Applebaum and Lenin and Stalin. These are national Bolshevik parties and movements that continue to gain adherence and are really the second largest party in Russia after the presidential, so-called presidential party. I think it's also interesting to note that when the Civil War finally ended and the Bolsheviks were firmly in power in 1921, you had a massive diphtheria epidemic begin. I believe firmly that the church has proven that it cannot govern itself. It needs to be mentioned more and more that the state, the crown is a religious institution, generally speaking, with the powers of a bishop, just a bishop at large. That's why the strictures and the oath that the monarch takes, the Orthodox emperor takes, is so detailed. And it's something that, you know, the Sunday of Orthodoxy anathemas he has to accept. The emperor alone can call an ecumenical synod. So Tsar Nicholas had that power. The church, without the guidance of the royal power, has been an utter disaster. Now, I'm not saying that there have been many saints and many wonderful parishes, but that's not what I mean. Institutionally, as a group, they've largely lost their way. Almost immediately after this, the new calendar is adopted, and ecumenism is slowly but surely pronounced. The true Orthodox movement, of course, is an obvious reaction to this. But post-Matthew essentially destroyed itself with schism. So unfortunately, the true Orthodox Church is not a viable alternative to what we call, or what Archbishop Averke calls, the world Orthodox. Not when you have 25, 30 organizations all mutually anathematizing each other. So it's not like you could just, you know, pick one. They mutually anathematize each other. The knowledge you have to pick one or the other is so detailed and picayune that there's no way. It is not viable. The church now is in a sorry state, at least institutionally now. The church as such remains identical to what it always was. You know, fullness of grace, the resurrection of Eden, and what nature was supposed to be has been manifest in the church. Regardless of what bishops and monks say about it, that they can't even see, that they can't even, you know, do the simplest job of even pointing to where it is, that they seem incapable of that, shows you what the church without the state is useless. They're subject to every fad intellectually, including the ridiculous idea that the crown and the state are the same thing. The OCA is always condemning our romantic love of long dead empires, as Theodosius said some years ago, having no clue what the father said about this. Here's another one of these examples where the church fathers are almost totally unanimous on something and they ignore it because it's inconvenient. Dmitry of Rostov makes it clear that king is the only legitimate government because it's the image of God. Sovereignty is unified, not dispersed. St. Photios the Great spent the most time on the subject, making the argument that one of the reasons the filioque is such a problem is that it's an attack on the emperor. Because in a sense, the Father and the Son, in council, so to speak, create the Holy Spirit, which then is projected in the law on earth. That's the polyarchic point of view. And there are those who see the filioque as the beginning of, you know, development of republicanism. This belief that since the Father and the Son, commiserate to create the Spirit, so to speak, that's very easy to see how it would manifest in politics. St. John of Kronstadt has the famous quote. He doesn't say in heaven there's a kingdom, in hell there's democracy. It's nonsense. He says in hell there's self-will, the foundation of political democracy. Of course, there's no democracy in hell. Satan rules it. But in a sense, to the extent that it's still God's presence, regardless, there's nothing democratic about it. What he means is that hell is this unfulfilled self-will, this unfulfilled desire for passions and pleasures that now can never be, this constant self-hatred that comes from this inability to satisfy the passions. This is the essence of hell in his mind. It's also made clear that the prophet Samuel did not condemn the concept of monarchy ever at any time. He condemned the concept of monarchy because they wanted to be like the other nations. That very phrase is fighting words. No, monarchy was perfectly acceptable. Melchizedek was a king. Deuteronomy lays out the duties of the monarch. So obviously Samuel is not condemning the idea. But this is some of the nonsense that developed in this modern age. The basic fundamentals of the church are ignored. Very famously, Gregory the Theologian makes it clear that if you believe in one God, you believe in one king. If you believe in many gods, then republicanism and democracy would make the most sense. Eusebius of Caesarea, very well known for saying that the crown is a single source of authority. Notice he doesn't say the state, the crown. It's a source of authority, not power. And it is superior to all other governments. Polytheism, the literal worship of beings other than God, numerous beings, lends itself to political democracy and republicanism. Isidore Pelusium spends some time talking about the subordinate nature, about the natural order itself is hierarchy, subordination. And therefore the royal power fits perfectly in the natural order. Theodosius the Studite, as is well known, the crown is the unity of the state, unity of sovereignty. There is one captain, one ship, one crown, one state. Very Platonic idea. St. Basil was a clear monarchist. The king is saved by the grace of God, not by an army. and a tyrant is known. You see this in Joseph of Volok and so many, dozens and dozens of others. You could talk about Philaret of Moscow, Nikolai Vamilovich. I mean, you know, church father after saint after saint after saint, all saying the same thing. Any government that seeks its own good is inherently illegitimate, and there is no duty to obey it under any circumstance. There's been the very poor English language scholarship on Joseph of Volok. It's all very upset that he doesn't have a detailed plan of how to rebel against unjust authority. Now, what he simply says is, like all his fathers said, when the power deviates from God, is no longer orthodox, seeks its own self or the enrichment of a faction, it no longer commands our obedience. It's no longer a power ordained by God. Therefore, what Paul says in Romans 13 is totally void. What Paul says in Romans 13 implies that the power is established by God and it's a godly power. In a ludicrous Protestant exposition of that, a biker gang that takes over a state has as much power as the president. I mean, it's stupid. Paul isn't saying that whoever has power, you obey. No, God has ordained this. Self-will is self-will, not ordained by God. Gregory Palamas, that it is natural. The natural order is monarch and emperor. Everything else is the invention of men. St. John Maximovich, of course, very well known as a firm royalist. I could go on and on and on. Therefore, it's clear that if you are an Orthodox person, you must be a monarchist. Now, in America, it's a little odd because we don't have really much of a tradition of anything, let alone crown, except being part of the British Commonwealth, I guess. But that, you know, that has no legitimacy at any level whatsoever. We can only talk about an Orthodox crown. Regardless, the clear consensus of the Church Fathers and Scriptures are that monarchy is the reflection of one God on earth, one unifying source of authority manifest in an individual, because God, in fact, is an individual. God's a person. The king is a person. Bankers and the elite often hide behind large institutions. You know, Parliament, of course, had full control over the colonies, you know, the colonial era. But it's hard to personify the Parliament. So you attack King George III, who was a very, very good man and a very devout man, according to the Anglican way. The consensus of the fathers is that monarchy is the only legitimate form of government, and therefore that the Roman model is the only source of legitimate authority. Notice I didn't say power, authority. Attempts to mimic this, as I said, Francisco Franco in Spain, the Iron Guard, whatever, all these different groups we talk about, Metoxas in Greece, they're all legitimate because they quite explicitly seek to restore some of that on the local level. It is the only source of authority. It's not an accident that Christ came into the world at the very height of the Roman Empire. The point of all of this is that the murderer of Tsar Nicholas was one of the most intensely powerful rituals that the Antichrist has ever produced. Without the murder of the Roman Emperor, there's nothing left. Without the murder of the Roman Emperor, Antichrist cannot exist. The banks, liberalism, the Jews could not take power if the Roman Empire existed. That's the significance here. And this is why the Talmud over and over again condemns Rome. The land power versus the merchant sea power. So remember the sacrifice of the royal new martyrs, the successes of the Russian crown in the 19th, especially the 19th century, how truly representative it is. And of course, in democracy, it represents only the wealthy. But as so many talks and lectures in this podcast have shown, only a strong monarch can go over the heads of powerful economic forces. And Putin is doing this in Russia as well. And it's one of the reasons why he was at the proper place on Athos, which is a separate issue altogether. So we must say that we are Orthodox monarchists. In some form or another, it would be understandable, the constitution of whether it be Byzantium, or Bulgaria, or Serbia, or Russia, because they all have the same source, they all have the same foundation, the double-headed eagle. The murder of the Tsar was a sacrifice to Satan for power. What has happened since 1918, the slaughter, the death, nuclear weapons, the rule of the banks, I mean, endless. It defies description. The hundreds of millions maimed and murdered. This doesn't prove to you that the notion of the Caton, the restrainer, the monarch, the Roman emperor really was, that he was the plug that kept Antichrist from functioning, then nothing will. Tsar Nicholas and the empress, and children should be our role models in many ways. And I beg of you to read more on them. Although the English language literature is very poor. Again, I appeal to you for funds. I can't even afford to go bankrupt in this rotten system. I give everything away for free. I ask my friends to please donate what they can. My website, www.rusjournal.org. Thank you very much. And Tsar Nicholas, pray to God for us.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.